Hello, I'm Chris Mackerel. This is number 0779, the Stuff File program, with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0779. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Dan Flanagan, who is a lawyer and a thriller writer. He's the author of An American Tragedy. It's the fourth book in a series of thrillers. As a lawyer, is he trying to right some of the wrongs within his profession with his writing?
Only incidentally. I don't think I'm at all afraid of showing the defects in the system, especially in this book, and how it can often be just a mere lottery and things go awry and some of the rules are nuts and the people involved. But that really isn't the primary thing necessarily. Really, I'm just trying to tell stories of people struggling with their situation and the larger situation and in a more interesting context and way than just gazing at my navel and doing it that way.
Actress and comic Jerry Jewell, best known as Cousin Jerry on the hit sitcom The Facts of Life, has written another book. This one is called Jerry's Jewels and Gems. Jerry first started doing stand-up comedy back in 1978 at the urging of a friend who was blind.
I was in college at the time and going to school with my friend Alex Valdez, who happens to be blind. And I was really bummed out. I was in the disabled services department. He goes, "What is the matter with you?" "Well, I'm flunking anatomy and physiology, and I really don't want to be in school. I want to be a comedian, like Carol Burnett." And he said, "Well, why don't you do what I do? I go to the comedy store every week and tell blind jokes." And I said, "That may work for you, but I can see perfectly fine."
Science writer Andrew Vazekas, the night sky guy, is on talking about Boeing's Starliner capsule that's now stuck at the International Space Station well over a month on what was supposed to be an 8-day trip. It's just the latest in a long list of problems for Boeing.
NASA picked two companies to build the replacement for the space shuttle, Boeing and SpaceX. SpaceX got their spaceship up and running in 2020. They've been sending crews taxiing to and from the space station for NASA since 2020. The problem is that the agency never expected that Boeing would take this long to also get up and run. And now here we are in July, the two astronauts from Starliner are still waiting on the International Space Station to come back.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0779, was Chris Mackerel, who is the owner of World FM in New Zealand, where the Stuff File program has been playing almost since day one. Thank you very much, Chris, for your support in playing this show. And also, thank you very much for doing the guest slate on this edition of the program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff. Can the upcoming U.S. election get any more weird? Well, there's one guy who's saying, "Hold my beer," as he tosses his hat into the ring. 35-year-old Dustin Eby, a middle school math teacher from North Texas, has thrown his hat into the ring in a big way. He's changed his legal name. Care to guess what it is now?
My name is literally anybody else, and I'm running for president of the United States of America.
I'm sorry. Explain the name to us.
The first name is literally, middle name is anybody, and the last name is else.
All righty then. Literally anybody else is running a write-in campaign for president of the United States in Texas, where he didn't get enough signatures to get on the ballot, and Tennessee, where he did get enough. Else has revealed his running mate, Neil David Sutz, a New Yorker who is currently living in Switzerland. else, said Americans deserve better than the divisive, partisan electoral system that we currently have. But he's also surprised by the amount of attention he's received, both in the U.S. and worldwide.
I should not be popular. There is zero reason why literally anybody else should be taking off the way it is.
You know, this is shades of how the Rhino Party started up here in Canada. And during a visit to the Channel Islands on July 16th, King Charles III took some time to bestow a special honor, a rare golden goat breed found on the island of Guernsey will now have the title of Royal Golden Guernsey Goat, which will apply to the breed anywhere in the world, said Rebecca Martin, the owner of the specimen the king met. Hopefully, this will raise awareness of the breed. The king reportedly favored the goat with a compliment about its pale blonde coat. Well, he's always liked blondes. Bet you didn't know about the Merlympics in Geneva, Switzerland. The event, in existence since 2015, is designed to prove athleticism among mermaid competitors.
This is a big secret you've been keeping from me? Is it that you're a mermaid, or is there something else?
At the May Games, 22-year-old Mia Sim of Provo, Utah, secured her title as the fastest mermaid in the world. Sim has been mermaiding for 10 years. At the Merlympics, athletes must compete in five categories, including ecology, which is diving to the bottom and picking up trash, underwater posing for photographs, and rescue, which is swimming to save a submerged dummy, all while wearing full mermaid or merman gear. Said Sim, "It's not a skill that's easily learned. This type of restriction on your body is very difficult for people to understand." She has now been inducted into Team USA and hopes other Utah mermaids will aspire to such heights. Or should I say, depths.
Behold the mermaid!
Meanwhile,
the force is strong with you.
The force is definitely with these folks in Mexico City. Students of the Jedi Knight Academy, who meet in a park four nights a week to practice their lightsaber dueling skills, said instructor Ulysses Vasquez, who's known as the Jedi Master. When students arrive, some of them drop the saber. He said they go on to become excellent athletes and excellent lightsaber fighters and fencers. The sessions, which last 3 hours, are based on Jedi and Sith teachings. Vasquez and his best friend, Gabriel Mendoza, opened the academy in 2019, at which point lightsaber dueling had already been recognized by the French Fencing Federation as an official competitive sport. Oh, it's only a matter of time before it's an Olympic sport.
Remember, the Force will be with you. Always.
Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Dan Flanagan is a lawyer and a thriller writer. He is the author of a series of books featuring private detective Peter O'Keefe. His latest book, which is the fourth in his series, is called An American Tragedy. Dan joins us via Zoom from Kansas City. Hi, Dan.
Hi.
Thanks for being on the program with us. One of the things I've found interesting, and I've had the opportunity to talk to a lot of thriller writers, and I've also talked to a lot of thriller writers who come from other professions. And usually when they come from other professions, you know, doctors write medical thrillers and, you know, Kathy Reichs writes about autopsies and the like, and it goes on and on and on. But you are a lawyer who's written about a private detective. Is there a reason why you went that way?
Well, it's sort of accidental that I'm writing crime novels. I say, I don't know if my mysteries are very mysterious or my thrillers are very thrilling. But when I wrote the first book in this, I really was just going to write a general kind of coming of age story. And I thought, no, let's make it more interesting than that. Let's do some kind of private detective crime mystery thing. And I did not want to fall into the trap of just the guy being me. And so I actually created a lawyer character that I could put my stuff in and, you know, have this guy stand on his own. And then once I embarked on this, the original book starts in 1986, I came up with the notion of I'm going to carry this group of characters and ones we add as far as I can up through, as close to the present day as I can, and sort of deal with the big issues, you know, as they intersect with these individuals in the society. So I hope that answers your question. But that, now this book, by the way, is almost all trial. So I've kind of gone over to the lawyer side in this book.
Well, you mentioned that your first book started in 1986, and your current one, the fourth one, is based in 1988. Was there a particular reason why you went back in time? I mean, you just mentioned that you're going to work your way up to present day, but was there a reason why you started, in essence, over 30 years ago?
Because I wrote it in 1986.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, the first draft of the book was written in 1986. I had an agent and a publisher. Publisher went bankrupt, and you know, just all the kind of crazy hassles you get. And I said, I'm not doing this anymore, and happily practiced law for another 20 years. But then, you know, if this writing thing grabs you, it really sticks with you. So I returned to it a few years ago and came up with this notion of how to do a series out of it and start with that.
So tell us what the story is in An American Tragedy.
One of the things that happened in the 80s in the U.S. that was really a big thing was a sort of intersection between what was called the Satanic Panic and a related, what they called a moral panic. And it involved lots of criminal prosecutions in a real environment of hysteria of teachers and babysitters and people like that in childcare for sexual abuse of children. There's a lot that went in to make this, but many of the prosecutions were really of innocent people. At least that's what most people who've investigated it believe. But a lot of people were convicted and went to prison for long terms with it. In terms of what I'm trying to do here, really trying to tell the history of our times in a way, I just could not really resist that. It's a tough thing to write about and to read about, but that's what I want.
Well, as a lawyer, is one of your missions here to kind of, through storytelling, right some of the wrongs within the legal profession?
Only incidentally. I don't think I'm at all afraid of showing the defects in the system, especially in this book, and how it can often be just a mere lottery and things go awry and some of the rules are nuts and the people involved. But that really isn't the primary thing necessarily. For example, the first three books, there's one trial in the second book that involves the SNL crisis, what I mean by a big financial crisis in the 80s. But really, I'm trying to tell stories of people struggling with their situation and the larger situation and in a more interesting context and way than just gazing at my navel and doing it that way.
I know you say you started writing these back in the 80s, and at the time you had a problem getting them published, but now you've written four books and you're still in that time. And I'm just wondering, are you spending each book dealing with something that was big at the time that the book takes place?
Yes. A big theme in the first three books, for example, is sort of the decline, the death throes of the traditional mafia in the United States. And O'Keefe's gotten himself in trouble with the mafia in the first book. And a lot of what happens in the first three books, not all of it, is about that. A lot of it's about this SNL financial crisis, various Ponzi schemes, the rise of evangelical Christian stuff that ended up being used by bad people to do things like defraud people. So it's that kind of intersection. And then this guy's struggling with his own life, right? Trying to build a business, all that. And the way those intersect is what I'm interested in doing.
Well, obviously, you've been successful because, you know, this is now your fourth book. We should mention the first three. That is Mink Eyes, The Guilt Tilt is the Big Tilt is the second one, and On Lonesome Roads is the third, and again, our current one. The fourth one is An American Tragedy. I'm just curious to know, especially considering you tend to not shy away from the underbelly of the legal profession, what have, if anything, your contemporaries, your co-workers, what do they have to say about the law from within your book?
You know, it's funny because I can't trust my people I'm close to. This is my opinion. Because I don't know if they're honest with me or not, you know. They're your friends, they're close to you, and that sort of thing. But I've had nothing but positive comments from that sort of group of people, and nothing really negative. But like I said, I'm not sure I can trust them being so nice.
At what point after Mink Eyes came out, or in the process of Mink Eyes coming out, at what point did you say to yourself, I've got more than one book in me. I've got a series of books. And do you see that series continuing indefinitely?
Yeah. As long as I can keep going, I'm going to do it because I've found, I think, a way to tell some interesting stories. And I have a lot of personal domestic stuff, too, with it. For example, I'm just starting the next book. And it's going to be about the rise of survivalism, white Christian stuff, you know, racist, you know, the whole militia thing and the things that led to the Oklahoma City bombing, basically. So
you've written.
I'm hoping to finally get out of the 80s. It took me four books.
You've written quite a few pieces within your legal profession. You've written books that deal with the legal profession, but of course your mysteries are novels. Was that a different kind of muscle to change your writing from the judicial writing to mysteries?
Well, it couldn't be. I guess I probably had to lose all that to write a novel that people wanted to read, just because it's such different approach and one's extremely dry and one's not. But I wanted to be a writer from the time I was a sophomore in high school. And I think I just had that in me. And so I was able to not have a big problem with doing something completely different.
Although, as you say, it's not necessarily completely different, because when you describe what some of the things you write about in your mysteries, I mean, I go back to some of the things you've written about. I believe your PhD dissertation was The Criminal Law of Slavery and Freedom from 1800 to 1868. And you were also a civil rights lawyer and a school desegregation lawyer. So obviously it's within the wheelhouse of what you did and do as a lawyer.
That's true. And even more so, as a finance lawyer, I've been in lots of bankruptcy and deals where, you know, financial scams and scandals and all that kind of thing. not being a perpetrator, but trying to deal, clean them up and that sort of thing. So that's been, I mean, Mink Eyes is about a mink farm Ponzi scheme down in the Missouri Ozarks. So it's and a case that I had as a young lawyer. So it's certainly, my case wasn't exciting as the one I made in the book, but it triggered it.
I often ask writers who have ongoing characters if they would like to see a movie or a TV show, but I understand that you've actually written a pilot for a TV series called O'Keefe.
I have, and wrote a feature film screenplay for Mink Eyes. That was really more to just sort of put it out there and try to show the world how it could be done. Not that I'm that world is a tough world, and I don't even know how to begin to navigate it. And someday I hope somebody picks it up and does it. But that was really more my effort to say, here it is, and see it can be done. You know, but nobody's picked it up or anything.
Well, maybe you'll be the next David E. Kelly. How about that?
I'll take that or anything less.
Dan, thank you very much for talking to us. Again, the book is called An American Tragedy. It was a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Dan Flanagan, author of An American Tragedy. You can go to our website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0779, and you'll find the link to Dan's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
There's still more guests, more news, and an idiot of the day coming your way on The Stuff File program. Stay tuned. The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Here's a penny for your thoughts from the Stuff File program coming to you from Montreal, Canada. A country that doesn't have pennies.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to actress and author Jerry Jewell. She has a new book out called Jerry's Jewels and Gems. Plus, Andrew Vazakis, the night sky guy, talks about the problems with Boeing's Starliner. Yes. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way and much more in Stuff File News right here, right now. At the Subversive Museum of Old and New Art in Tasmania, three paintings displayed in the women's restroom and billed as works by Pablo Picasso have been revealed to have been created by another artist, museum curator Keisha Kashela. The paintings had hung in the women-only gallery for 3 years, said Kashela. I imagine that a Picasso scholar, or maybe just a Picasso fan, or maybe just someone who Googles things, would visit the ladies' lounge and expose me on social media. She was expecting to be caught, especially because she accidentally hung one of the works upside down. The ladies' lounge originally offered high tea, massages, and champagne served by male butlers. The idea, Kashela said, was for men to feel as excluded as possible. But when the Tasmanian Civil and Administrative Tribunal ordered the museum to allow men in, Kashela installed a working toilet in the space and called it a restroom. When asked by reporters about the authenticity of the Picassos, Kashela confessed that she had painted them. You know, you have to check out this woman on social media. I get the feeling that her fake paintings and the controversy with the tribunal and her desire to appeal their ruling and the media that continues to surround her is in itself an art installation, and she is having the time of her life spoofing just about everything while getting her point across. A 33-year-old man named Jing from Hubei province in China has put technology to work for him. When he suspected his wife Wu of having an affair with a co-worker, Jing used a drone to follow her. Jing said his wife became cold to him last year and also changed her position at work and visited her parents more often. The surveillance revealed that Wu went to a remote area where she walked hand in hand with a man and disappeared for about 20 minutes into a dilapidated mud house. Said Jing, her other man is her boss. He plans to use the footage in a divorce case. You see, when you're doing something clandestine, you have to look all around you and also look up. Yeah. Ever go into a store and lose all track of time? When police in New Smyrna Beach, Florida, were called to a Walgreens store around 3 a.m. on July 15th, they could see a man inside helping himself to a pack of Newport cigarettes. They talked to Christopher Morgan and talked him through unlocking the front door and asked him if there was anyone else in the building. In apparent confusion, he replied that he didn't know. "I came in here to use the bathroom," he explained, "but that was more than 5 hours before, around 9:40 p.m., when security footage showed him entering the restroom. He didn't come out until 2:42 a.m. When police asked him what time he thought it was, he said, "Probably around 11 o'clock. While locked in the store alone, Morgan feasted on junk food, Tostitos, spinach dip, chips, Reese's and Ghirardelli chocolate, and Dr. Pepper. Morgan resisted arrest and spit on an officer. He was charged with burglary and larceny petty theft.
Let's talk about making things easier. Walgreens is here.
Yeah, but that's only during business hours. And finally in this section of Stuff File News, those bells signify that it's time once again for The Darwin File.
I am the Grim Reaper. I am death.
This is the Rules Don't Apply to Me, South Africa edition. On July the 7th in South Africa, a visitor to the Pilanesberg National Park lost his life after being trampled by an elephant. The 43-year-old man was driving through the park when he left his car and approached a herd to take photographs. Three other people in the car were unharmed. The elephant herd included young calves, which may have made the adults more aggressive. Piet Nell, chief conservation officer for the Northwest Parks and Tourism Board, said visitors are explicitly instructed not to leave their cars. We must remember that you are entering a wild area. Well, everybody was warned, but some people feel that the rules don't apply to them. Gee, I hope someone saved that SIM card to get that last picture. Anyway, that's why the Tree of Life is often self-pruning.
I have come for you.
And let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? It's been 11 years since we last spoke to comic and actress Jerry Jewell, who is best known for her role as Cousin Jerry on the hit NBC sitcom The Facts of Life. Back then, we spoke to her about her memoir entitled I'm Walking as Straight as I Can, Transcending Disability in Hollywood and Beyond. Well, she's got a new book out. This one is called Jerry's Jewels and Gems, and it's a collection of columns that she wrote for Ability Magazine over the years. Jerry joins us via Zoom from California. Hi, Jerry.
Hello, Peter.
Nice to chat with you once again. When you started writing these columns for Ability Magazine over a period of 6 years, did you ever think at that time when you first started that you would eventually have a book out of it?
No, I didn't think that far. But during COVID, when COVID hit, it was like I needed to do something that I didn't have to go outside and do. And I asked Chet Cooper, who is the editor of Ability, if I could use the articles for a coffee table book. And he said, no problem, as long as you give us credit, where credit is due, and I have no problem with that.
So, as again, I said, back then, we spoke 11 years ago about your previous book, I'm Walking as Straight as I Can, and I'm just wondering, between now and then, have things improved for the visibility of and the accessibility of those who are disabled?
I mean, it's fluidity, you know. It's one day at a time, and we've come a long way, but we still have a long way to go. The people with disabilities have the highest unemployment rate, and that needs to change.
In your estimation, what are the hurdles that you still have, that other people still have, as you talk about it from your Ability Magazine stories, what are the hurdles that still haven't been challenged?
Just auditioning people with disabilities, qualified actors with disabilities for roles, regardless of what the disability is. I mean, I could be a teacher, I could be a mother, I could be a lawyer. I couldn't be a brain surgeon, though. That would be kind of tough.
You started out, as I mentioned, you did stand-up comedy and you were an actress. How did that begin for you? I know we talked about this a little bit 11 years ago, but for those who haven't heard that particular interview, that show, how did it begin for you? Because, you know, a lot of people, when we first saw you was when you hit the screen on the NBC sitcom, The Facts of Life, but we don't know necessarily how you got there.
Well, I started doing comedy at the Comedy Store in 1978. And I got there because I was in college at the time and going to school with my friend Alex Valdez, who happens to be blind. And I was really bummed out. I was in the disabled services department. He goes, "What is the matter with you?" "Well, I'm flunking anatomy and physiology, probably algebra again. And I really don't want to be in school. What do you want to do?" "I want to be an actress. I want to be a comedian like Carol Burnett." And he said, "Well, why don't you do what I do? What do you do?" "Well, I go to the Comedy Store every week and tell blind jokes." And I said, "Alex, that may work for you, but I can see perfectly fine." And he said, "No, dinky face. You go to the Comedy Store and tell cerebral palsy jokes, and the rest is history."
Now, when you first decided that this was what you wanted to do, what did the friends and family around you, besides that particular friend who was encouraging, what did they say about your goals and dreams at the time?
Well, let's put it this way. My parents would have been happier if I stayed in college, and because I was just going to transfer to either UCLA or Cal State Fullerton. And I just told them that I'm only young once and I want to go after my dream. And if I don't make it in 5 years, I'll go back to school. That was the deal I made. So I never went back to school.
Your current book, which is called Jerry's Jewels and Gems, there is a foreword written in the book by Norman Lear. And of course, we recently lost Norman not that long ago. What, first of all, how easy was it for you to get a foreword by Norman? And what was that relationship like? And what do you have to say about Norman now that he's no longer with us?
Well, Norman has always been like a surrogate dad to me. I mean, we used to FaceTime all the time. He would call me just to check on me and see how I was. And I asked him if he would write a foreword for my book. And he said, "Sure, bring it over to the house." So I went over there and I showed it to him. And I said, "It's a coffee table book, Norman." And he said, "Well, what if they don't have a coffee table? Are they still going to buy it?" And I said, "Well, if you write the foreword, it'll help." So, no, I was joking, but he wrote the foreword at 101, if you can imagine.
I can imagine, absolutely. Your book, which again is called Jerry's Jewels and Gems, again, you wrote this based on articles that you wrote for Ability Magazine. I'm going on the assumption that Ability Magazine is a magazine that is that is geared to those who have disabilities of one kind or another. But I'm assuming that your book, you want everyone to read this, not just those who have any kind of disability, but those who are abled, as the saying goes. Would that be accurate?
Of course. You know, it's because I wrote for a magazine, I had to be real careful. I couldn't be political. You know, my own agenda had to be very fit everybody. And so the book will not end up on the banned book list. because it applies to all of us. In fact, when I was reading the columns getting ready to do the book, I thought, oh my God, these columns are just as valid today as they were back then, and even more so today. We need the inspiration. We need the laughter. We need the insight and the spirituality that I have given in the book. So it was magical. It was like, wow, I actually have a book here.
Can you give us an example of something that would be within the book, Jerry's Jewels and Gems?
You know, every chapter is so radically different. There's one about, it's called The Jury Is Out, and that was my one time as a juror. I served on a jury, and I was never asked again. And that's a really wonderful one. Actually, the whole book. There's one about going grocery shopping with my dad when I was a kid that I remember about it. The subjects are so vast, and there's a chapter about pets. There's a chapter about my cat, Harry, who passed away, and what I experienced with Harry's passing. There's a chapter about a stolen scrapbook from me in the 80s, and 30 years later it was given back to me because of Facebook. He FaceTimed me and said, I have your scrapbook. What? I don't have a scrapbook. And he sent me a photo of it, and he said, yes, you do. Oh my God. Because my apartment was broken into several times. So that was amazing to get that back 30 years later.
For those, and again, I mentioned your role on the hit NBC sitcom, The Facts of Life, but that, of course, is by no means the only thing that you have done. You've been in Deadwood. You've been on 21 Jump Street. You were in The Young and the Restless. So you've had a very long and fruitful career. Is there anything you're doing now outside of promoting this book? Are there any acting gigs that you've done recently that you're willing to share?
There is a documentary in the works on my life. That's going on, and I actually have two more books that I'm working on at the same time. And I found that, well, I've always known this, and even my mother said, I'm so surprised that you went into acting because you are a writer first. You've always been a writer. And Mom was right. I love writing. I enjoy it. And I don't have to worry about, my body movements. You don't have to worry about any of that when you write. So it's an outlet to convey without doing the stand-up comedy.
When is your documentary planned for release? I know you're still working on it, but when do you anticipate that it'll be ready for the viewing public?
We keep shifting it. So I cannot give you a date at this point, but it will definitely get done.
Well, when it is done, will you come back on the program and talk to us about it?
Oh, of course. Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Excellent. Well, again, the current book, that is called Jerry's Jewels and Gems. And once again, Jerry, I thank you for being on the program with us once again. Please don't wait 11 years to be on the show with us again.
All right. Thank you, Peter.
Comic and actress Jerry Jewell. Once again, her book is called Jerry's Jewels and Gems. You can check out Jerry's site at jerryjewell.com. And you can go to our website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0779, and you'll find the link to her site, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Michael Libling is the author of The Serial Killer's Son Takes a Wife. It's a page-turning thriller. You say you've read other serial killer novels? Oh, as Michael will tell you, not like this one.
It's not like any serial killer novel you've read before. It really goes behind the scenes. So when I say he takes a wife, you've got to imagine what it's like to be the offspring of somebody who's murdered multiple people. So how do you live with yourself after that? You were just a kid when it all happened. If you fall in love, how do you tell the woman you love your dad was a serial killer? And how would she react? So the title, it's not entirely clear. But as you get into it, it will become very clear.
The Serial Killer's Son Takes a Wife. It's a recipe for mystery with a scoop of humor and a sprinkle of horror. The Serial Killer's Son Takes a Wife. Available now at Amazon and wherever you buy books.
Coming to you from Canada, a place where fighting is frowned upon, unless it's on an ice rink. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, the Stuff File presents Andrew Fazekas, the Night Sky Guy. It's radio that's out of this world.
Andrew Fazekas, the Night Sky Guy, is a member of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada and author of National Geographic's Backyard Guide to the Night Sky, and also National Geographic's Stargazer's Atlas, the Ultimate Guide to the Night Sky. And Andrew, we've avoided talking about the mission of the Boeing Starliner because at the time of this taping, it's a mission that has been plagued with issues right from the launch pad.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, absolutely. Boeing just doesn't seem to have luck on their side lately, have they? And we're talking about, of course, the Starliner, their spacecraft that they built under contract for NASA, right? It's a $4 billion contract to build a spacecraft that will ferry astronauts back and forth from the International Space Station. They launched their first test flight carrying humans back in early June. I think it was like June 5th.
June the 5th,
and
yes.
June 5th, and the plan was that it was going to be an 8-day mission, you know, stay on the International Space Station for about a week, basically doing a complete shakedown of their Starliner spacecraft.
Yeah, the actual return date was June the 13th.
Doesn't that seem like a long time ago?
Yeah.
So really, this is a vital mission for Boeing to basically certify the spacecraft for regular operation with NASA. And, you know, you go back, NASA picked two companies to build the replacement for the space shuttle that was retired back in 2011. And that was Boeing and SpaceX. Now, SpaceX got their spaceship Dragon up and running in 2020. They've been sending crews taxiing to and from the space station for NASA since 2020. The problem is that the agency never expected that Boeing would take this long to also get up and run. And so far, all NASA's eggs in terms of taxiing service has been with Elon Musk's SpaceX Dragon capsule. And they're still waiting for Boeing. And now here we are in July. The two astronauts from Starliner are still waiting on the International Space Station to come back.
Yeah. And both you and I discussed this off air several times. And never brought it up on the show because I don't think either one of us were overly excited about the mission through the various stages up until the launch. We were just like saying, yeah, well, we'll see if this gets off the ground kind of thing. And it was also from a perspective of the look and the feel of Starliners, it seemed like old technology. It seemed like watching 1950s Chevrolets in Havana.
Yeah, I mean, especially when you compare it to SpaceX Dragon capsule, that looks like something out of Space Odyssey 2001, right? I mean, it's so sleek. It's like it looks like something that Apple may have built, right? It's so sleek and very ultra modern. And you've got Boeing, you know, an old school, long legacy of aerospace building of spacecrafts. And, you know, it's tried and true in some respects. It's a great old design. And I'm sure it's filled with a lot of more modern technology, but still, it just, you know, I think we've been tainted as the public looking at it of seeing what great successes SpaceX is doing, what it looks like, how they market and promote themselves. And Boeing undergoing so many difficulties, trials and tribulations regarding their jetliner, you know, their Boeing fiascos, the jet plane disasters that they've been dealing with, PR disasters, and then of course these constant delays and problems, these technical issues that keep cropping up with their Starliner spacecraft. It just paints the whole thing in a very different light, I think, for the public. And we just, you know, the enthusiasm isn't there. And I think it's okay in the sense of safety that they are doing their due diligence. NASA is now taking a more overriding view in their partnership, and they're more progressive in their oversight, which is great for safety. But still, it just doesn't have that confidence with the public. They've lost a lot of creds, I think, with the public. Boeing has.
And again, we've talked about this for years. When we first saw the design of the Starliner, I think both of us said, isn't this just a bulked up rehash of the Apollo capsule?
Absolutely. It does look very, harkens back so much. I mean, like I said, the overall design is tried and true. But then you see what SpaceX has done in terms of taking that to the next level. It doesn't seem like Boeing has really done that, and it does look like a clunker compared to what SpaceX has. And I think because SpaceX got out of the gate now literally 4 years ago in starting operations, actually ferrying astronauts, taxiing them, we're like, that's what the public is expecting. So the bar was set very high, I think, in terms of expectations for Boeing, and they just haven't been able to meet that level.
Well, let's move on from the Starliner and its visit to the International Space Station and talk about another space station that isn't up there yet, but there is NASA's Gateway space station, which is planned for a lunar orbit, and Canada has already begun work on the Canada Arm 3, which is going to be part of that space station.
Yeah, this is amazing for Canada. It's a contract worth over $1 billion Canadian, and it's pivotal, critical, can't understate this, to the success of what is going to be part of the human's return to the moon. And it's not just a quick jaunt to the moon like we did in Apollo, but there to work and stay long term. And with that whole scenario that NASA's planning with their Artemis mission, they want to have a support system in the form of a lunar orbiting space station. It won't be permanently occupied like the International Space Station orbiting the Earth. It'll be there as a drop-off point, a stop-off point for astronauts on their way to and from the surface of the moon. It's called Gateway. It's supposed to come online in 2029. So in about 5 years, it's delayed. There's been a lot of delays, but right now it's scheduled to go into operation in 5 years. And it will be outfitted with this new generation Canada Arm, very similar to what we've seen on the International Space Station, which was Canada Arm 2. And of course, the first generation being on the space shuttle fleet, the famous Canada Arm that put out, you know, grabbed satellites and such. This one is going to be really a 21st century version of it. It's about 28 feet long, multiple joints, outfitted with artificial intelligence. It has to work autonomously because this robotic arm is going to be pivotal in building the space station that it'll be attached to, and also eventually doing the work of grabbing satellites to and from that are going to be visiting as they're being shuttled between our two worlds, Earth and the Moon. And so Canada is right now in the phase of building this 28-foot robotic arm and outfitting it so that it can autonomously work. So there'll be times when the space station will be not occupied by humans, and this robotic arm will have to help maintain the gateway space station, like things like changing out batteries and scientific instruments, things like that. It needs to work autonomously, because you have to remember, Peter, it's going to be about 400,000 kilometers away from us. And so there's no chance of a quick visit by astronauts to do repairs. It'll have to be able to do that on its own.
Now, will this space station be in orbit, or will it be stationary above the moon's surface?
Yeah, so it'll actually, that's a good question. It's going to actually be in a in orbit around the moon, and they haven't released all the details of exactly how that's going to all work out. But the idea is that it's kind of like a safe spot for astronauts that are traveling between and a kind of a waypoint, a transfer station, as you can imagine, between the surface of the moon and the Earth. It's going to be occupied for brief amounts of times as the astronauts are leaving or going to the moon.
Well, the reason why I ask the question is you talk about the fact that the Canada arm has to be autonomous, and is one of the reasons being that, again, as you say, it won't be constantly manned, but also there is a lack of communication on the far side of the moon.
Absolutely. So if it is orbiting the moon, which looks like it will be, there'll be times where it will be out of contact, potentially, with Earth. But I think things are going to be changing. It shows already they're thinking about this. So there is no kind of dead space in terms of communication around the moon. By putting, having communication satellites around the moon. This is a huge, endeavor that they're thinking of, because of, if we want humans to permanently occupy the surface of the moon, we need to make sure that there is always backup communications. Also, if there's any assets on the dark side of the moon, on the far side that never is facing the Earth, we want to make sure those regions also have the ability to communicate. There are already a couple of satellites like that. Even China has their own satellite. They recently had a sample return from the far side of the moon, and they were able to stay in contact with their rover by using satellites that were orbiting the moon. So these kind of communication satellites that we rely on here on Earth, we want to replicate in a more modest form, obviously, but around the moon, that allows us to have 24-hour communication. So that kind of issue might just go away in the next decade.
Well, speaking of satellites, I also wanted to talk about satellites doing damage to the ozone layer. And also, speaking of satellites, the fact that the ISS astronauts had to safely shelter from an errant satellite. But we are out of time. So can we go to Patreon and do this as a Patreon reward extra?
Absolutely. Let's do it.
Okay, sir.
Clear skies.
Andrew Fizakis, the night sky guy. You can go to our website at thestuffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0779, and you'll find links to Andrew's site to get your own personal autographed copy of his books. And Patreon subscribers, you can hear more of Andrew as a Patreon reward extra, where we'll discuss some problems with satellites, both the damage they can cause while orbiting and the damage they can cause to our atmosphere when their orbit is over. Just go to our Patreon page, and if you're not already a member, become one of the select patrons of the show. Visit patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. We do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way in just a few moments, but I've got one more Stuff File news story to share with you right here, right now. An Ohio man who allegedly burglarized a Petland store and set loose some animals was found with several hamsters stuffed in his pockets when cops discovered him sleeping in a leopard print onesie outside a nearby business. And once again, those are words that I would never have thought to put together in one sentence, but there you go. 31-year-old Matthew Pancake was arrested on July the 9th for breaking into several stores in Columbus, Ohio. When investigators arrived outside the pet store, they found dogs, birds, bunnies, and a hamster in the parking lot outside. Some other small animals were still unaccounted for. In addition to Petland, Pancake is accused of breaking the front door glass and entering a Rooster's restaurant and a shoe store. Officers found Pancake, who has an extensive rap sheet, asleep near a Big Lots store. A police frisk turned up the purloined rodents. Charged with vandalism and breaking and entering, both felonies, Pancake was booked into the Franklin County Jail after being treated at a local hospital for injuries he apparently suffered during the pre-dawn break-ins. You know, those hamsters who were found stuffed in the pockets of his leopard print onesie, they're going to need therapy. Anyway, boys and girls, it's that moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
A woman slashed tires on 17 Waymo robo-taxis last month. But the high-tech vehicle's cameras captured footage that led to her arrest. 36-year-old Ronale Joshua Burton pleaded not guilty to vandalism charges at her arraignment. The district attorney's office said Burton targeted the self-driving Waymo vehicles between June 24th and June 26th in the San Francisco area. Each count alleges damage exceeding $400. A Waymo spokesperson said that in some instances, riders were present in the vehicles when Burton allegedly slashed their tires. The company is seeking damages. Prosecutors also allege the incidents are connected to another case where Burton is accused of using a knife to slash tires on a three-car Waymo caravan. Cameras on the Waymo cars also captured footage of that incident. Burton is being held without bail after prosecutors successfully argued she poses a public safety risk. Now, why? Oh, why would you slash the tires on 17 robo-taxis, which in reality are autonomous vehicles with a viewing and recording range of 360 degrees? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0779. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0779. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook, Spoutable, Mastodon, and Blue Sky as PA Holder. Check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including kdxradio.com, over the air on World FM in New Zealand, WLSL-LP-FM in Dade City, Florida, KZZH-LP-FM in Eureka, California, CKUW-FM in Winnipeg, CFMU in Hamilton, CKLU in Sudbury, Local 107.3 FM in St. John, CHSR in Fredericton, CFQR 600 in Montreal, and also streaming on just about any streaming service your little heart desires. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Today's broadcast could be heard directly in your home, car, or wireless device, or on your computer, so you can listen on an outpatient basis. For those of you hearing the show directly inside your head, please adjust your medication.